Blimey. This is one out of a jam jar you got here.
House of Mystery contains demons, angels, elementals, magicians, wizards, apparitions, adult language, and discussions. If you're easily offended, do not enter the House of Mystery.
All right, then. On with the show.
Okay, we are here. This is the House of Mystery, the John Constantine and Friends podcast. I am Michael, your host, and with me, as per usual, and I wouldn't have it any other way, is the demon bisexual butler, David Sabal. Hello.
As I live and breathe.
In this episode, we are discussing John Constantine Hellblazer, Dead in America, issue number 2, which is technically issue, 14 of Spurrier's Hellblazer run?
Yes.
So where to begin? Because there's a lot of stuff going on in this particular issue. We have vampires and annoying so-called influencers being ripped to shreds. We have explanations behind what's going on with the green, or at least clues,
more like clues.
We now have the answer that we were hoping to get. We are dealing with Alec Holland's Swamp Thing and not Levi, which was Ram V's creation, about 2 years ago during his Swamp Thing run. Okay, so this issue takes a lot of ongoing narrative threads from DC lore, prior writings, and things started in Spurrier's earlier 2020 story arc and begins to intersect some and reintroduce others. And we're going to get into all of that. Now, if you are a new House of Mystery listener, you accidentally discovered us via the social media links, you can find all of our shows, past, present, and in the future, pretty much wherever you listen to podcasts. Just search House of Mystery. I know we had some problems with distribution during our last show. People were struggling to find our new episode on Spotify and Podbean, and that was simply because I was in the middle of doing massive updates to our RSS feeds. So I was doing a lot of back-end work, and because of that, it broke some of those links, but they should all be repaired now. So if you had those problems, just go back and check your go-to podcast aggregator, and it should be fine. Okay, so one thing I can appreciate so far is that Spurrier is not attempting to change the original concept of his story, which was, if you remember, David, was to place Constantine out of his element.
Yes.
One strategy employed to make this happen was to rip or take John from near death and place him in a setting that is unfamiliar. There was this idea that the world had moved on and everything, like his allies and foes and situations, were all new to him now. And he was effectively left to fend and figure things out on his own and had to recruit new people that he wasn't quite sure he could trust. That's why we have Noah. That's why we have Nat. And though we were led to believe that everything Constantine was familiar with had moved on, Dream, as well as Swamp Thing, have both now resurfaced and have been reintroduced, now very carefully, mind you, in a way that can excuse their temporary absence.
Yes.
For example, Dream's power and control is being contested by an unknown. Swamp Thing was manipulated into thinking by that same unknown that he's no longer needed.
Needed, yeah.
And there's more to this, and we'll get into that bit in just a moment. But my point is that despite these introductions, it still fits with Spurrier's original designs for John Constantine.
Yeah. And also, it kind of answers the one question that everyone's had since the very beginning. Where is John? Is he in the main DC universe, or is he somewhere else? Was he placed in another multiverse universe that is away from the main universe? And right now, you'd have to say that basically he's not in the main universe of DC.
The main continuity.
Which
we've been saying that.
Which we've been saying.
Because based on Spurrier's earlier run, I mean, that's clear. Mm-hmm. John was ripped, or I should say a variation of John that we actually never got to see. He was simply a future potential.
Yes.
That never actually happened. However, that version of John that was dying in a future that we actually never saw realized was ripped from that continuity and placed someplace else. And we still don't quite know where that place is. Mm-hmm. However, it's starting to feel like it's a Vertigo variant.
Yes. And we're getting closer to that answer too, because like, just like what you said, this now with this particular issue, we have an inkling that we are in Vertigo. We are in the old Vertigo time of Vertigo series.
Are we?
But
are we? Are we in a Sandman universe? Yes. That is basically a variant of Vertigo.
And like, also you have to throw in the fact that we started the story with the fact that the character of John Constantine finds out that he's been missing for, I believe, like 20 years.
Something like that, yeah.
Because everyone else that he knows has either disappeared or moved away.
And the world is very different.
And the world is very different.
That was also brought to the forefront, I believe, in that first one-shot issue that came out, what, December 2019?
Yeah.
That this world, he's unfamiliar with it because he was ripped from time.
Yes. And that's what I got from this. Is kind of like, I kind of have like this idea now that Spurrier is trying to show that the main entities that are really were powerful in this universe was Swamp Thing and Sandman, and they were taken out, but also John Constantine.
Yeah. I don't want to get into the weeds too much with this because I'm sure eventually, although I don't really need it at this point, we'll get some clarification. I know there are people out there really, really about trying to figure out where we are. And I just don't think it's really that important to the story.
Yeah, that's the thing.
I don't think it was ever meant to be important. Spurrier, just being a smart writer and clever as he is, was simply trying to find a way to bring a Vertigo John back. That was the point. The point was to leave behind the flashy New 52 John Constantine and reintroduce readers to the more subtle, nuanced Vertigo version of Constantine.
Yes.
That was the point. I don't think it was designed to create these mysteries of like, someday we're going to find out. If we find out, fine. That'll be fine. But I don't think we need to keep trying to figure it out. I mean, listen, it's fun to figure it out and try to,
it's not,
you know, wrestle with those different ideas, but it's not the point of the story.
Yeah, it's not the main mystery.
No, it was just a plot element.
Yes.
To get the story going. And the reason why I even bring it up, Dave, is because when you go through social media and you see the articles being posted, it seems like a lot of people are confused. A lot of people are confused, and maybe that could be a reason why, an argument to be made why possibly Spurrier may, in fact, answer that question more formally because of all the confusion. I see people talking about Levi, Ram V, Swamp Thing making an appearance possibly in the Parliament of the Gears because of what they're doing with this particular storyline in issue two. And I kind of chuckle. I'm like, Levi's Ram V is a Ram V's Levi or Ram V Swamp Thing. I don't think this guy exists. I don't think Levi exists in this world. We're not in that. Now, Ram V Swamp Thing is in the prime continuity. It's in the prime universe. We are not in that universe.
Not in that universe.
Now, I'm not saying there couldn't be a Levi here, but it's probably very unlikely that we're going to see that.
Oh, yeah.
All right, David. So what are your initial thoughts on issue two? Because there's a lot.
My initial thoughts on issue two was there was a lot to like in the story, but this is the one issue where I think Cy Spurrier was doing a lot of heavy lifting with his dialogue, where you have to read this issue at least more than once, more than even twice, to actually kind of see what he's trying to say and what, because he's dealing with so much moving parts in his story. I was expecting him to kind of take his time and basically say, this issue, we're going to deal with this. This issue, we're going to deal with this. Here, in this issue, he throws at least, I counted like three or four, but you actually, off the air when we were discussing about it, we're finding more than those. Where he was like going, here's this part, here's this part, here's this issue that's coming up. And it's kind of like, okay, I know it's the second issue, and I love what Spurrier is trying to do, because I can, this is the issue where I basically see the most creativity.
He's doing a lot of juggling.
Yeah. Creative juggling that he's done even more so than the original Hellblazer run that he started off with.
Well, he didn't have to juggle as much because it was essentially a new story. Now he's trying to bridge his run with other ideas.
With other ideas.
While also trying to say something relevant about today's culture.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of work. That isn't easy.
And that's why I think that basically after the end of it, I was like going, okay, I want to be honest, I didn't give this issue a really high grade. It wasn't bad. I still enjoyed it, but there were so many moving parts. I was like, my brain was left trying to figure out, okay, what the hell is he trying to say? It's kind of like what I've always alluded to when it comes to writing and comic books is, what are you trying to say with this character? And about like the second to third time I reread the issue, I began realizing he's trying to lay down other areas of his story. So we're not going to be able to see these things right away in one issue. It's probably going to take at least a couple of issues to bring everything together that he wants to say. He's laying the groundwork down right now. So at that point, I took a step back and I was like, okay, I'm willing to actually see what he's doing. Because in all honesty, after the third time, I was like looking at his writing style, I'm like going, it made me chuckle because it made me think about writers like how Neil Gaiman is very wordy with his dialogue.
Yeah, I totally get what you're saying. During the first issue, or I should say during my first read through of the second issue, I did feel like it was a bit convoluted.
Because like, there's a lot.
Not that it was bad. I mean, Cy Spurrier can't write bad. I mean, the guy is fucking great.
Yeah.
He's a good writer. Typically, when I look at a read of whatever it may be, when I'm doing a close reading of a comic, a book, whatever it may be, a movie, I try to condense my thoughts down to a single idea. What is he trying to say? What is the artist, the writer, the director trying to say here? And during my first read, I was having difficulties pinpointing one distinct idea. It felt like there was like seven different things all coming together.
Yeah.
However, after my second read, I was able to do that. I was able to bring all of those ideas under one theme. And I feel like it has everything to do with cultural and societal hegemony, power structures. That was the overarching idea of the issue, and everything else was simply supportive.
Well, yeah, especially I think an easier way to put it, and maybe our listeners will understand, is like usually in a comic book, when me and you are covering it, we have a story A and a story B. Story A is the strength of the entire story in the issue, and it's what drives us forward. Story B, you know, will
usually support
it.
Yeah.
In this particular one, you start off with story A, then you have story B, then you're introduced to a story C, then you have a story D.
And also not only do you have additional, you know, story A, story B, story C, but you also have ideas being introduced into each story.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're doing a simple read through, it doesn't feel like it's meshing. But if you read with a close eye and a fine-tooth comb, you realize that everything does work together. It's just very dense. It's very dense.
Yeah.
There's a lot there.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, an interesting component to this issue is the dissection of cultural and societal hegemony and the part it plays in recorded history, which is this notion that history is written by the victors. That's something that most of us are familiar with. That's a very common saying now.
Yes, it's something that everyone can understand.
Yeah. But outside of this idea that history is written by the winners, there's also this strong sense built into the narrative itself that would also suggest, or does suggest, the idea that historical accounts, since this is what we are talking about here, mm-hmm. may undergo changes or interpretations when they are recounted and retold. And we see that a lot. Oftentimes history is, or the recounting or retelling of history is very subjective.
Oh, yeah.
And based on the perspectives of the ones doing the retelling.
That's what I really liked about that scene with Clarice and Nat, when mm-hmm. she was explaining to her the idea of a myth changing, because they wanted the myth to mean this, but instead it did this. And that was the first, one of the first examples I started finding in my rereading of the issue, where it was like, okay, he's trying to tackle, just like what you said, trying to tackle this overall theme that the people in control are the ones who control the narrative.
And if you control the narrative, that's the ultimate power. That's
the power, yeah. Because like, that's why when I look back at it now, that scene with, I don't know if that was supposed to be Sandman himself or Morpheus, but the hitchhiker scene in the very beginning, when the unknown entity, basically after they slaughter the hypnotized cop, and then send out the APB bulletin on Constantine and crew, the hitchhiker ghost shows up again from issue one, and the unknown entity goes on a rant about how you're not supposed to be here. You don't have the power. We have the power now. They're going to listen to us, type of dialogue. And when you pair that up with what Clarice was trying to tell Nat, this is what happens with myths, then you start seeing what Spurrier is actually piecing together. It's not like what we alluded to, where it's all these different stories. It's story A, story B, story C, story D. All of them are interconnected by one overall theme, and that's what you were bringing up about how everything is connected by that.
Structures of power.
Structures of power.
Yeah.
And when you think about the perfect person to break the structure of power is someone who is an anarchist, who is someone who can destroy the system, so to speak, that is in his core John Constantine. Constantine is the anti-establishment type of character that basically, if it's something about order, he's against it. He knows how to break it. And
he is the type of individual that will lift the middle finger to yes. the people in power.
And yeah, and that's why it's like hilarious that Constantine, when you put together Spurrier's story from the first Hellblazer run, and in these last two issues, especially in particular with issue number two, you begin to realize what Spurrier's trying to establish universe-wise is the importance of Constantine, not to just the world, but the entire God universe. Like, he is like the fail-safe button that keeps the gods in control.
Yeah, and we'll see where that goes, because a lot of this seems to be dealing with old structures of power, yes. which we'll get to that in a second. But first, David, just to add to this revolving theme or themes, the secondary theme that correlates with the notion of power is the commentary on the way structures of power plays in the shaping of certain stories. Now, we mentioned about the retelling and the repackaging, but also how certain people, the powerless, and as the writing said, the lucky ones at least, are forgotten. So during this repackaging and retelling through the people in power. The ones who are powerless remain unrecorded. They don't have a voice. But these are the lucky ones. The ones who are not lucky, and they are the powerless, are the ones that are then recast as monsters.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm wondering if they're trying to say something about these new powers in America. Are these formerly forgotten, powerless individuals that were recast as monsters, and now they're trying to reclaim their story? That's a question that we could tackle towards the end of the discussion here, because there's other things to support. Perhaps the way we're looking at this isn't the way we're supposed to be looking at this. Meaning, are these three villains, air quotes, the girl, the old woman, and the cop, are they actually not the villains we think they are? Or had they just simply been recast as the monsters? That's something I want to let simmer for a while, because even if we don't get the answers right away, I love the theory. And I do think there's a lot there, especially when we look at what possibly the vampire, the influencer scene meant. Because if you just look at it from face value, it doesn't really quite make sense to the rest of the story. Why is it there?
Yeah.
But if you look at what it could mean metaphorically and you try to interpret it, it might be talking about power struggle as well. So, David, if we get into like psychoanalytical film theory and literature studies of Gothic horror, you will also see how writers as far back as the 18th century, they also coded their writings with various ways to alleviate anxieties and fears. So if this is something that we see Spurrier utilizing, this idea of including certain ideas, for example, the idea of recasting individuals as monsters, which is what Gothic horror did oftentimes, specifically when you're dealing with the fears of castration, where they then deem women the monster, which happens quite often in the horror film.
Yes.
Another relevant theme that could support all of this is the idea that we're living in this post-truth world. If you look at the idea of reinterpretation and history being told by the victors, we suddenly realize, well, is there any objective truths then?
Mm-hmm.
What are we dealing with? Well, if you look at what Hellblazer has always done best, the writers of Hellblazer, they've always used Hellblazer to simply delve into socio-political commentary, to talk about the times.
Yes.
And a lot of philosophers and sociologists will argue that we are indeed in a post-truth world. The uncovering of this bit was more or less reliant on the combination of the first two themes we just went over and the knowledge of the current socio-political and cultural climate here in the United States and others. So when you take all of that into account, and when I say United States and others, I'm talking about, of course, the West. I think Western civilization is probably taking the brunt of a lot of the cultural changes that are happening currently. So upon my second read, I was able to bring all of those themes together, because during my first reading, it just felt like a lot of ideas. But when you realize that they're actually supportive ideas, then suddenly that feeling of convoluted writing, actually, it streamlines it a bit. Which, listen, I probably should have been fair to Spurrier. We know Spurrier is not a simplistic writer. He's a very detail-oriented, complex writer.
Especially when you're talking about the universe that he's dealing with right now. Something that might help people further understand our point with how we perceive these characters in this story. Think about the old Hellblazer type of universe that was built. You didn't have normal villains and heroes. Villainy was almost like personified. And you had things, emotions and aspects that don't normally are personified, have some personification. Like, say, for example, death. Death in Vertigo was personified as kind of like this goth girl that was the sister of Morpheus. It was a different in those type of stories. Was she the villain? No, but she is the personification of death, which is, you know, perceived as a negative thing. And here,
not if you're into that.
Yeah. But like when you're, oh, trust me, she had a big, gigantic fan base back in the day. I used to remember people had posters and posters of
perverts.
Death as, yeah.
Perverts.
I was not, one of those people,
perverts.
That fell in love with the goth.
I had one too.
But like when it comes to this dawned on me after the third time I read the issue, where it's like, okay, I'm looking at this like as if this is supposed to be a mainstay DC universe type of comic. And then I thought to myself, well, wait a minute, the villains here aren't necessarily the villains. They're just aspects. They could be representing certain aspects that may be correlated to being villainous, but they're not really. They're just basically because it's based on the current landscape culturally that they live in. And that's why it started ticking in my brain that basically look at like all the characters, how they're reacting. They're telling these old guard type of characters like Sandman, like Clarice, talking about Swamp Thing, telling them, no, your time's past. You were told you don't need to be needed anymore. You can go away. We have this right here. This is one of the lines in the book, in the story, said it all out. One of the characters says, it's our time. And I'm like, going, oh, okay.
David, it does seem like we're dealing with something a little more deeper than simply, you know, binary good and evil.
Yeah, because you have to remember, as readers, we are in the Sandman universe.
Operates in the gray.
It operates in the gray and not just basically black and white.
Yeah. Yeah, there is an interesting interpretation you can go with what you were talking about, because you're dealing with structures of power. You're dealing mm-hmm. with old power and you're dealing with new power. And when you have people saying this is our time, it seems to reflect a very common thought in today's political rhetoric mm-hmm. that the old are no longer relevant, or you can look at it from another perspective. They are the reasons why we are in the problems we currently are in
today.
They are the mm-hmm. cause of the problems because of their choices, their decisions. And now it's time for the young, the progressive, to take control and fix the errors of
the old
guard. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So there are things you can derive from the issue, as well as, you know, things that are happening here in our country culturally that could actually support that idea. Now, just to backtrack for a second, for context, when it comes to post-truth, because all of this intertwines, it is, I would say, well known that many have lost faith and trust in our institutions of power.
Oh, yeah.
Of late, and as a byproduct, lost faith in fields of expertise, history, science, just to name a few. Now, the term post-truth simply refers to a situation in which emotional or personal beliefs have more influence on public opinion than objective facts. Philosophically speaking, the concept of living in a post-truth world actually reflects a concern about the erosion of traditional reliance on objective truth.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the best way of saying it, and the increasing impact of subjective emotions, personal beliefs, and narratives in shaping public discourse. And not wanting to get too far into the weeds here, I think listeners can start to see how all these ideas in this issue reflect a very relevant commentary on today's world.
Oh, yeah. Especially when you do take a step back and don't focus on the fact that
Ignore the plot, because you're not going to get this if you're a plot reader. If you're just following plot, then you're going to be like, well, what I saw was a vampire and an influencer.
Exactly. And that's the thing. As strange as it sounds, this is an issue where you have to ignore the plot. You have to look at the you almost have to look at what's behind the words than the words themselves.
In an issue like this, the plot is simply the way you're transporting larger ideas.
It's supposed to, in a lot of ways, to me, it's like the plot is going to progress in real time. It's going to continue time forward, right?
Everything that's happening now is happening now. Well,
what about then?
We missed it.
We missed it.
When?
Just now. Now. When will now be now?
All the all the Gen Zs out there were like, who the fuck are these old people talking about? It's a classic.
Oh, it's a classic.
All right, David. So let's talk a little bit about Swamp Thing.
Dude, I loved his reintroduction.
Yeah. We have our answers pertaining to the identity of Swampy. It is Alec Holland's Swamp Thing. But he was manipulated into essentially shutting himself off to the green and the world in general. This aspect is intriguing, Dave, because of how it actually assists with the above themes that we were talking about. Mm-hmm. For one, the manipulation speaks on and actually adds to the aspect of post-truth and not knowing fact from fabrication, opinion, and emotion. And it adds layers and contextualizes the notion of cultural hegemony. Now, as it pertains to story development and plot, we can see that these new powers, just to add to our thoughts a few moments ago, have taken or attempting to take or seize power in the United States are not just targeting Dream, one structure of power, but it seems with their attack on Swamp Thing, they have their sights set on all former and esoteric powers.
Yes.
The question remains, though, David, who are these three individuals who have taken the form of a young girl, an old lady, and a police officer?
Oh, there's a lot of
speculation. Is that the mystery in this episode or in this story run, in this story arc? Because the last story arc, it was, what is old John Constantine up to? That was the mystery.
Yes.
What type of game is he trying to play on himself? Which is still genius, in my opinion.
and you,
which is great.
You got to remember his motivation was to make John a better John.
Only because of why, though.
Exactly.
It was for his own game. It was
only for his own game because he wanted to once again beat fate. Now, that leads into the speculation. And one of the coolest theories I thought about after I started thinking about trying to piece this puzzle, as I usually do when it comes to like Constantine stories, especially like this, where you're trying to piece all of the red string together.
Yeah.
And you begin to realize that the whole story of Siceberger's run is about the main villain's focus was to what? Deny fate. Then you get into the second story arc and you have three women. Both of them, especially the old lady when that's talking to Swamp Thing, is talking about, you did a good job, hon. It's time. It's your time to rest. We can take it from here. Almost like saying that we can control the fate now. It's not up to you anymore to save destiny. And then I started thinking about, well, there's three of them. What if they actually do the aspects like this is the three sisters of fate, you know, from Greek mythology.
Have we seen them in DC before?
Never. We've never seen it before, okay, but I wouldn't be surprised if, because you have a young girl.
That's not a bad theory, because look at the story that Clarice shared. We got a backstory on her that I do not believe was ever shared in the Vertigo story, that she is actually, her origins actually date back to ancient Greece.
And that's when, you know, like I started.
Her name's Clarice, right?
Clarice Sackville.
Yeah.
And that's where I started actually piecing it together, like, you know, Sunny, It's Always Sunny from Philadelphia, where you piece up the theory person and I'm standing there going, this is making all sense now. But that's when I started piecing it all together and saying the ongoing theory I've seen online, and one of the funnest ones, is the fact that this is the three sisters of fate getting tired of all these superheroes and all these magic gods trying to
change their fate. Yeah.
And they basically say, no, we're tired of this. We're going to stand in. And this is what we have decided is your fate. you're going to be stuck in this fate. And when you think about it, when it comes to John Constantine, who is the one person that loves basically just throwing a monkey wrench into fate's work on his own behalf?
Yeah.
Is John Constantine.
Of course. Yeah.
So like, it would make sense that the people that took him out of time would be the three fates, because they don't want him to muck about.
You mean remove him?
Yeah, remove him.
You think that's what they're gonna... Well, listen, I don't know if they... Okay, so you bring up an interesting topic, but it doesn't seem... hold on.
Because...
They did kill the police officer.
Yes.
Okay, because I was gonna say, have they done anything malicious yet?
No. They just were cleaning up. They killed
the police officer, which, okay, you can point and say, well, what was the reason behind it? They have a good reason. Maybe we'll find that out later. However, they could have killed John Constantine. They just gave him a warning and left, the cheerleader. They also could have possibly killed Swamp Thing, but they just lulled him to sleep.
Yeah.
They don't seem like they're trying to kill these people.
No, because they understand that basically all of them have an important fate. They have an important place in destiny.
Yeah. That's why I think it's much bigger than simply, we are bad.
Yeah.
Blech. I think it's a little more complicated than that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But we do know, David, that typically when you bring in a story, when you bring Swamp Thing into a story like this, there's going to be some ecological messaging.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Will that actually have a part to play with these three as well? Because there was a bit dealing with the decay of the green with lines like the topsoil whispering in carcinogenic urgency.
Urgency.
I mean, yes, you could say Spurrier is just trying to be true to Swamp Thing and introduce an element that deals with the environment. But it also would feel a little lazy if he just did that so it feels right. I would say or argue that there is some ecological issues here as well.
Yes.
Not entirely sure if all of this or all of it will play a big part in the larger myth arc, but the concept of a deep ecology in philosophy might shed light on potential narrative strategy.
Well, if you find out that basically one of the powers is tied, kind of like in Ram v. Swamp Thing, how he brought in the
Parliament of Gears.
Parliament of Gears. If they make any allusions to a power of industry of some kind, then we know that basically, yeah, this is the point of Swamp Thing.
Well, David, listen to this part here and then continue that thought, okay? So deep ecology is a philosophical and environmental movement that actually goes beyond traditional environmentalism. And it aims to address the root causes of ecological problems by examining the underlying philosophical and cultural beliefs
yes,
that contribute to environmental degradation. So from a sheer position of conjecture here, we could interpret that these three villains are in some way responsible as well for the environmental degradation as well.
Yeah.
And then that would also feel a lot more seamless by introducing Swamp Thing. Because if you're bringing in Swamp Thing, there has to be a greater purpose.
There has to be, yeah.
And that purpose usually has to be connected to the environment. Some ecological statement that the writer is trying to make. Could this become something similar to Ram V's Parliament of Gears, which is a metaphor for industry and capitalism run amok? It could be.
It could be. It could be.
But also, you have to be careful because I don't think Spurrier is a hack. And if you get too close to what was already done, it might come off as hacky. But it doesn't mean there isn't room to do something that still fits in a similar fashion.
Well, in fact, I think
it's all about execution.
It's really all about execution. But also, I think the setting fits this more than it did for Ram V. Because Ram V's Swamp Thing was stuck because he was stuck in a universe where superheroes run amok. Where basically there is, in the overall DC landscape, it is good versus evil, black and white. Here in Hellblazer, there's no such thing as black and white. It's all shades of gray. It's you think this person's a villain, but in actuality, he's a product of his environment. Much like in the very beginning with when the first Hellblazer run, we all thought that basically that one being that got introduced in Hellblazer was a villain. And we begin to realize, no, he's just a product of like the fisherman, the mermaid one.
Oh, yeah.
We all thought the mermaid was the monster.
Yeah.
No, it was the product. It was the fisherman that basically created the mermaid.
Yeah.
And that when you look at like what Sicebreaker has always tackled, especially since the original Hellblazer, he has a way of mixing that type of writing where it's like there's no good or bad or evil. It's kind of like
it's just reality.
It's reality.
It's just how it is.
It is kind of like what you alluded to.
It might be ugly, but that's just the facts, right?
Yeah. It is kind of like what you alluded to, where like the losers tend to get created into the monster. You know, they get portrayed as the monster, and in actuality, they're not the monster. The monster is the one who created the problem from the get-go.
And that's essentially what happened in that issue you're talking about, mm-hmm. the mermaid issue. Yeah, it's a good callback, Dave. You're right. So let's talk about the influencer and the vampire. What point does it actually serve? Clearly, there are plot motivations, but as most are aware, when dealing with writers like Spurrier, plot is not where we will find all the answers. Instead, answers lie within the abstractions, like metaphors and allegories that enrich the narrative with deeper layers of meaning. That being said, what can we take away from this? So let's look at one particular aspect, which would be metaphorical justice. The vampire's action may symbolize a form of metaphorical justice or retribution against the social media influencer for spreading harmful and discriminatory views. And this interpretation, the supernatural element, serves as a creative way to address societal issues and the consequences of spreading hate. I'm not sold on that one. There could be parts of that, but I'm not completely sold on that 100%. The scene could be an exploration of power dynamics. This one I would agree with more, with the vampire representing a force that holds individuals accountable for their actions. This interpretation may delve into the idea that individuals who misuse their influence or engage in harmful behavior may face consequences from unexpected sources. Does that not fit a lot more with our discussion?
Yes. When you throw it in like that.
And it makes sense of that opening scene, mm-hmm. because it really doesn't fit anywhere. Now, obviously, it's going to continue down the road in other issues. But when you're looking at this individual issue as a standalone, you have to wonder, where with all of these other things going on, what does this really matter? Like, what part does this play?
Exactly. And then when you look at like the overall, not what's happening, but like the symbolism that is going on, you have an influencer being torn apart by the vampire. And when you read the definition that you just read, does that not now fit all the symbolism?
Yeah. Yeah. Now there's a third one, Dave, another interpretation here. On commentary and social media impact that I feel like possibly fits with the post-truth theme. The use of a social media influencer as a target could be a commentary on the real world impact of online platforms and the potential harm caused by individuals who misuse their influence to spread hate or discriminatory ideologies. The vampire's actions may highlight the severity of the consequences in a symbolic manner. So that fits with the last one I read, as well as the post-truth aspect. And then lastly, there's the empowerment narrative. The vampire's actions might be interpreted as empowering, depicting the oppressed or those targeted by discrimination taking a stand against their oppressors. And that could be the simple binary of the power and the powerless.
Yeah. And when you throw it in the in with the story of what Clarice was talking about, how her character was oppressed by a god, by Apollo. And then you take that into context. Again, you see the symbolism there. You know, you have Clarice, a character that has been, you know, ravaged by this god at one time. And she goes on, this is her origin story. This is what caused her. And then you throw in the whole idea of what the influencer and the vampire fit in. Then you know, those red strings that I talked about earlier start making sense. But the thing is, you have to ignore the plot.
Yeah.
You have to ignore it to actually see it there.
So, David, then this begs the question again, are the three villains actually villains or some type of cosmic justice?
I think I'll go further and say they're representations of an aspect, of a new aspect that is representative of the culture at this time.
We're going to be way off, and I'm going to blame Spurrier for it. Like, dude, why didn't you listen to our discussions and rewrite your comic book, even though they've been done for several months?
At least choose one so we can figure out who's right.
Yeah. But, David, I will say that history is on our side, because a lot of our theories do end up happening when we're dissecting comics.
Oh, when we're doing comics, yes.
Or I guess you can say books.
Yeah. When it's comics, I take pride in the fact that I can tell and I can be a fate seer.
Oh, look at you.
Of like what the story is going to be.
Well, I'm going to recast you as a monster, okay? All right, David, quickly, let's get into our final thoughts. Give me your RMD score and any last bits you want to add.
As I said in the very beginning of the show, I could have easily given this a very low score because of like all the threads that Spurrier threw at us in one issue. It's a lot to digest. I mean, as I said earlier, I counted four story beats. And then when me and you were talking about it off air, you said like you found at least like six.
There's stuff that I left out because.
Yeah. And
it's
like,
just a lot.
But when we do what I said, which is you ignore the plot and you look at like, what is the overall story and theme that he's trying to tackle? It starts coming into focus. This is the issue where it starts kind of focus, and you can get a little lost. So my low score started just ticking up a little bit more, and it ended up at a 85. I had an 85 for this issue. I think it's a really cool issue. It definitely harkens back to old Hellblazer from the 80s. I mean, that's the strength that I've always said Cy Spurrier has with his run. Is I'm going to say the writer who we shall never name again in Tom Taylor. That's where Tom Taylor gets it wrong. He doesn't understand how Hellblazer.
He doesn't understand the character.
He doesn't understand the character or the themes of what it means to be in the Vertigo universe.
Yeah.
Spurrier does. And it really feels like we are diving back into the universe of Vertigo where capes aren't going to be, you know, Superman is not going to come in and swoop in and save the day.
Superman's bad.
Yeah, Superman's bad. Capes are bad. But like those characters are not here in this universe. The only heroes you have.
We don't know that for sure, though.
But the aspects that basically, yeah, we don't know for sure. But
we can only surmise that because of Spurrier's interviews leading to his initial run, which was removing John Constantine from the world of capes.
From the world of capes.
Was his like number one agenda with that first issue.
Yeah. And then when you think about it, with these past two issues in his second run, he's establishing that the main quote unquote heroes of this universe, Dream, Swamp Thing, Alec Holland Swamp Thing, and John Constantine, all basically were like, you could say, me and you have always said they're the Trinity of Vertigo. Where you have in the main DC universe, you have Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman. Here in the Vertigo universe, they don't have power here. The power actually lies on those three characters.
Yeah. Yeah. when you start looking at the choices that Spurrier is making here when it comes to characters and who he's bringing in, it does seem more and more like he is dealing with commentary on power.
Yes,
it does. All right, David, I'm going to follow you up with an 88%. I feel ashamed of myself just a bit because I do not believe I've ever scored a Spurrier comic that we've covered below 90. There are narrative problems that I found with this, and maybe not plot, but the way that the narrative is the shape. I'm going to keep it simple. If people don't know exactly what I mean by narrative, I know there's that word's thrown out all the time, and it seems like many people use that word to describe plot, which they're two different things. But the way the narrative is shaped, it doesn't quite gel. It's still very well written. There are so many great ideas. It's philosophically just rich. There is so much. It's gorgeously put together in the ways of visuals, and the use of themes is strong. And I pretty much can get a handle on what he's doing, but there are things that feels like there's a lot of obstacles and roadblocks that he's putting in his own way.
Yes. He's putting challenges.
Now, you could also look at this as being a midpoint, possibly, of his overall story, since technically this is issue 14, and perhaps this is a bridge issue where he is trying to bring several key elements together so that he can just push forward seamlessly with the rest of the story. That could be the case.
That could be the case.
Again, it sounds like we're saying negative shit, but it's not. It's still a very, very good read. It's just not as strong as other issues we've read from Spurrier.
Yeah.
All right. That brings us to the end of our discussion. I want to remind people to check us out on Patreon. If you go to patreon.com/Rainman Digital, you can subscribe to our Oblivion Bar discussion, which is a mini version of this show, and it's only $1 a month. So subscribe, YouTube watchers, give us a thumbs up and subscribe. Thank you, David.
Thank you.
Cheers, wankers. See you never.